Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and we are at Interbike 2016 with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hey, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And another special guest. And
drum roll.
This one's pretty excited. Nate's really excited about this.
I'm so excited.
I am too.
Yeah, we have mountain bike coach and trials rider and professional rider Ryan Leach with us. What's up, Ryan?
Cool. Greetings, guys. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Stoked.
Yeah. We're all really excited to have you here. Yeah. We're going to talk about how to handle a bike today in a bunch of different circumstances, and hopefully things that all of us can actually just go out and apply and in whatever circumstances we are in and become a better rider, because we mostly focus on the power side of things with our app, right? We yep. focus on educating you and making you faster in terms of power output.
My limiter, though, is bike handling.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Yep.
In every, unless it's a triathlon or an easy road race, it's bike handling that slows me down.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say you guys got the power side, and that's actually a massively important aspect for cleaning challenging sections of trail. And that's actually something that a lot of riders I work with don't have, is that torque. And power. So that's actually a huge plus to get you going.
Yeah.
But then it's a matter of coordinating your body to do what you need it to do.
So before we get into that kind of stuff, we should talk about what trials riding is. Can you describe what that is?
Yeah, for sure. So trials riding, it's always hard to describe, much easier to demonstrate, which is why I've
says
made
you
it, which is yeah. Yeah. Yeah, says me. So for me, it's been easy to demonstrate, and that's actually what I've made a career out of for the last 20 years, performing, demonstrating trials riding. But if I had to describe it, it's really slow speed technical mountain biking, and trials riders kind of take that to an extreme, riding over big boulders, logs, ledges. A lot about balance, a lot about just really dynamic body movement patterns to manipulate the bike in ways that doesn't seem possible, really.
Is there a good video for people, like if they stop the podcast to see? So we use a chat system inside of our business,
cool. Yeah.
And we'll put out videos, and I've seen some of yours, and I get, my heart raises sitting at my desk at work, and I'm like, oh, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Oh, yes.
Well, yeah, I guess one video, because trial skills translate beautifully to mountain biking, and so one video I did called Cranked 5, it's on YouTube, it's available, so Ryan Leach, Cranked 5, and can kind of see where some of these trial skills can be advantageous and interesting to use on the trail.
And you should see this in the show title, but it's R-Y-A-N, that's Ryan, and then Leach is L-E-E-C-H. So that way you can look it up, and that is correct, right, Leach?
Yeah, or just punch in Ryan Leach, and there's tons of videos cool. over my career that are up there. So, yeah.
And for those that are also another way to kind of describe how I've described it in the past, if you've seen parkour, like guys that run and jump on crazy things and balance on stuff, over buildings and that stuff, trials riding is kind of like parkour on a bike. Like you're vaulting over different things or up to things or riding in different situations that require an extreme amount of balance and
yes.
generally have consequences too if things don't go well.
Quite often.
Guessing.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No doubt. So how did you get started in riding and when?
I grew up next to a forest and started just riding my bike through the forest, through puddles, having fun. Discovered that, hey, wow, this is an actual sport. I picked up a mountain biking magazine at the store and was like blown away, and that was it. This is my love, my passion. And so I just started racing, racing cross country, racing downhill.
This?
So that was, I was 13 when I got my first mountain bike.
Okay.
So that's, do the math, I guess, 23 years ago.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
All right.
That's awesome. So you started in mountain biking. What got you into trials then?
So yeah, training, cross country, I it was awesome, and I did well, and I noticed some improvement. But then I saw a trials show at one of the events I was at, and thought, oh, that's a fun thing to mess around with, in my spare time. But upon messing around, I was noticing improvement, based on my practice ethic. I would go out, try to learn something and learn it, and that feeling, that satisfaction of figuring out the right movement pattern to perform and manipulate my bike was unbelievable. It was just that quick hit of satisfaction that I could fine pretty much every day after school, racing home, get on the bike, practice, and...
Yeah, you talk about that on some of your courses. I've felt that like four times in my career, where you do something just perfect, and I'm like, oh, that felt so good, and then I chase it.
Yeah. It's like a swoosh basketball. It's like that perfect drive in golf, you know? It just keeps you coming back for more, and that's what I got out of it.
So how we found you, we've talked about it before, is I actually saw an ad for your stuff. I mean, I've seen your videos before, but I didn't connect it with Ryan Leach. And then I saw an ad on Facebook, and you were bunny hopping stuff. And I went, that looks so beautiful. And he goes, learn how to bunny hop.
Yeah.
And I signed up. And so you have, we don't want to make a Ryan Leach commercial, but so everyone knows, you have a set of instructional videos, either subscription-based or you can buy them.
Yeah.
I've bought your bunny hop, manual, track stand. I think that's what I've done. And I started, I jumped right into bunny hopping, which probably...
Good pun, not intended. Good pun, yeah, I was going to say good pun. I'm a dad now, so dad jokes are not lost on me.
Yeah,
yeah, it's good.
But, okay, so setting back, everyone on the podcast knows I am really bad at bike handling.
Yeah.
How do you... Yeah, really bad. And you're much taller than I thought you'd be. I thought you were going to be like... I've always had this excuse in my brain that tall guys, because of where their center of gravity is, it would be harder to have... good bike handling skills, but we just were talking about you're 6'1". You look taller. So you're not like 5'4" or 5'6" or something
right.
like that.
Right.
How do you start off? Like how should I start training to get better bike? And I know that's such a huge thing, but should I just start like on a track stand?
Right. Or I mean, absolutely. Track stands are wonderful to work through progressions to learn track standing is. It's a great place to start in terms of slow speed confidence, and that translates beautifully to the skill to the trail in so many ways. Just knowing that you don't get sketchy as soon as you slow down on the trail, like that will give you buy you enough time to generate the speed to get over the next section.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I'll take like a bad line on a climb, and then I'll feel that, or on a tight switchback, I'll feel sketchy, and I'll want to bail.
Sure. And so, you know, that is just a few extra moments of stability during slow speed sections is enough to keep you going, to keep you from kind of sketching out and putting your foot down and losing all momentum. And then, you know, the amount of wasted energy and effort that comes from having to do that on the trail is just ridiculous.
Especially on a race, if it's really steep. I usually have to run my bike up on mountain bike race up to a point where I can start again.
Mm-hmm. Totally, yeah. And then you just and then you're dealing with people around you, and
they're
in a race situation,
at me.
And
that happens.
But I want to just address that that height factor. It's interesting. Throughout my career, I've always thought, I'm a competitive person. I compare myself to other riders and. Often look for excuses. Oh, they're tall, so they can do that better than me. Oh, they're short.
That's natural for us.
Right, of course. Yep. And you know, it's interesting. Those sort of some of those beliefs. It's amazing how kind of behind the scenes they might affect our learning curve and our potential. And so, I haven't honestly noticed any definitive patterns in terms of height and performance in mountain biking. Both in trials riding and, you know, downhill racing, you know, there's pros at the high end of the spectrum.
Of, very tall.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Greg Minar, he's a downhill rider. He's very tall. I think he's 6'2", 6'3".
Steve Pete. He's way up there.
Yeah. Yep.
Ryan Trebin, he's like 6'5",
6'6".
Yeah. Yeah, all shorter than me.
Yeah. So there's Nate putting that thought into his head.
No. What do you think of dropper posts? For handling.
Oh, it's interesting. Someone was asking me about what I thought the most sort of advantageous or technological innovation that's affected my riding most, and I chose dropper post, hands down. Like I would rather go back to riding a 26-inch wheel mountain bike with a dropper post than if I had like a 29-inch, which I love. I'm riding one of those as one of my favorite bikes right now.
What bike is that, by the way?
It's a Norco Optic.
Optic. Yeah. And is that full suspension?
Full suspension.
How much travel does it have?
110 millimeter.
So it's a short travel bike.
Short travel bike that has a little more of an aggressive all mountain geometry. So.
And you find that sufficient for the majority of your riding?
Yeah, for sure.
That's something that like really really quick, I don't want to take us off on too much of an aside, but that's something that I think a lot of people might misunderstand when they go into a bike shop. You see bikes that have short travel and longer travel, and a lot of the time, because the popular bikes that sell right now have 140 to 160 millimeters of travel.
Yeah.
They're called all mountain or enduro bikes. And they are very good, and it's amazing that they can descend like they do and still climb like they do. But chances are you don't need that bike. It gives you a lot of suspension that you probably aren't going to use. It makes the bike a little less stable feeling, kind of bobbly, like you're standing on a waterbed too.
Yeah.
And with a bike with less travel, you might be a better, more capable rider even.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a good chance that I think some of the listeners here are, they're into fitness. They want to climb. And yeah. having a bike that climbs beautifully is such a joy, especially technical climbs, like just a bike, you know, the more slacker head tube angle enduro style bikes. I mean, yeah, they climb, but you're sacrificing your climbing experience. And I love climbing. Mm. Probably, I mean, I argue I love a single track climb as much or more than the downhill parts.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah,
I love it more.
So getting back to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about exactly. I want to talk about that. So there's two parts we've hit on, both mental. The track stands gives you that little extra bit of mental confidence mm-hmm. to be able to go through. And then two, limiters where I'm myself imposing this thing that I'm tall, so I'm going into it thinking this is gonna be harder for me compared to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you, and this has happened to me and someone else asked this question, and you've probably had some big crashes in your life.
Mm-hmm.
How, when you have a crash, or it's my last mountain bike race, on the first lap, I crashed 5 times.
Ugh.
And I was like, I didn't finish. I was like, it was too advanced for me. But how do you like go from the point where, you know, you crash and maybe some people, I didn't break any bones, but crash mm-hmm. hard. And how do you get that mm-hmm. mental confidence back?
Mm-hmm.
Or with me too, I'm to the point where, so I used to be, I wouldn't go fast enough where I'd never crash and I'd always be scared.
Mm.
And now I've kind of let loose a little bit, but so I'm not holding back, but I'm crashing.
Yeah.
And that's getting frustrating.
Totally.
How do you get through that?
It's a big issue. This is a pretty massive topic, because mountain biking is a lot of fun, but it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And crashing sucks. Injuries suck. And so being a better rider is safer. It's rare that I crash. Sure, it's gonna happen and I am gonna crash again.
Yeah.
But because I'm a good rider, I crash less. But to get better requires crashing.
Yeah.
To a certain point. I mean, I would hate to say that, okay, if you wanna get into mountain biking, you're gonna crash. But it's a good exercise to really assess how willing am I to crash and be injured in terms of wanting to improve.
Yeah,
because right? that's the trick, I think. And we even had a question from one of our listeners on this not long ago, and they were wondering the mechanical things that they could do after like crashing. What are the things that they should do or the steps they should take to come back and kind of get rid of that fear that they have that seems to hold them back? Because they mentioned, I crashed, I came back on the bike, and even in this case, she mentioned I was fearless on the bike before I crashed, and now I feel so sketchy on the bike.
Tight.
She's riding tight.
Totally.
She's uncomfortable.
And then that makes it more dangerous.
Right.
Yeah. You know,
so what can they do the steps to reverse that?
Really, so yeah, I've had crashes in my career.
Yeah.
I've had injuries.
And yours have huge consequences.
And they have, for sure. I mean, I generally have been a fairly conservative rider, ironically, you know.
I can't believe
based on, it's all relative.
If you watch his trials videos, you might not say that.
You know,
it's amazing.
I generally am a very calculated, thoughtful rider. You know, it really is. I stop whenever I get that feeling of tentativeness, of fear. I've really learned to listen to it and manage to overcome my ego's drive to keep up with my buddies or to not look bad for stopping. And then just walk the section. Or if I've got time, look at it, understand it. And this links to what to do after a crash, really understanding why the crash happened. And not just, and it might not be a mistake you made on the trail, but that's really good to understand. What was the trail like? What was the situation like? How was my bike set up? You know, what could I do differently that might prevent it? If you can get clear on that, then the chance of fear coming up in that situation again will be vastly reduced. But you've got to investigate. Go back to the same crash site. Check it out. Be at that site. And then the other factors, Are you hungover? You know, is there some shit going on in your life that is stressing you out? You know, what were some of those factors that may have contributed to the crash in an indirect way? You know, all these are factors. So.
Yeah. One thing that I think that we've all experienced, too, is the fact that, you know, we talked about when you come back and you tighten up on the bike after a crash like that and you feel uncomfortable. Is there any type of exercise you've done? Because I'm sure you've had bad days on the bike, too, when you come, or if you come back from an injury or not, you just feel tight and out of sorts and uncomfortable on the bike. Is there something you do to kind of recalibrate in that moment to salvage the day or change things around?
For sure, for sure. Yeah, it is kind of a sad thing if you go for a ride and you're not feeling it. Is the ride a write-off? But it definitely is. I mean, you know, just breath, really.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, that's like, it doesn't get any more powerful than a big inhale and open mouth, just exhale, just relaxing the body, just a like not just the breath, but physically just kind of just letting your body just kind of relax and just hang and just that long. Maybe it might take a few of those just to gain enough perspective to salvage the ride and to loosen up the body. So perhaps you can flow. Find that flow again.
This is good for me because one thing that happens is I'll go ride with Jonathan, Jonathan's a very good bike handler, like national level for cross country.
Yeah, for cross country and local races. I'm the type of guy that always does well on the descents, and I'm good at climbing, but exceptionally good on the descents. Having said that, if you were to put me next to Ryan Leach here, I would look like I'm on a Strider and I'm like a 2 year old. But
I go with Jonathan, we go on things where it's totally easy for Jonathan. Jonathan's a beginner. Mm-hmm. Scaring me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm tight.
Yeah.
And Jonathan's flying down, and I think I have to be at the same kind of speed.
Sure.
And I think I should kind of recalibrate and start over on some easier stuff like the... I actually went to a pump track to practice things.
Yeah.
And I was on... It was with a bunch of, like, 6-year-olds and 10-year-olds. Like, you know, on
perfect.
Their little bikes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's...
But it made me feel better.
They're the funnest people to ride with, too. They are more stoked on riding their bikes than any adult, right? Yeah. They're having fun.
Yeah. How do you feel about pads, too, for increasing confidence?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No doubt. And flat pedals.
Yeah.
It's a big topic.
Mm.
Big
topic. Let's talk about flat pedals. When do you think someone should use flat pedals?
When?
Yeah.
So, new riders, like someone new to mountain biking, there shouldn't even be an option for clipless pedals for them.
Hmm.
Shouldn't even be allowed, in my opinion. It's like, not only do they have to figure out how to like use the gears and like use the brakes and like feel how the tires feel on dirt and on bumps, but then to try to like learn that movement pattern of clicking in and clipping out at the right time, takes time to develop that clicking in, clicking out. To think about it when something goes wrong, to think about it is it takes too long.
Right.
And that's the last. So I mean, they cause more crashes and cause more harm.
Do you think that clipless pedals lend to bad technique? I mean, they actually let you get away with things you wouldn't otherwise get away with.
Especially someone that's only known clipless pedals.
Yeah.
It does create. It reduces the need to learn the most effective body movement pattern. So there's a lot of shortcuts and sort of go arounds from yanking on the pedals in different ways that gets the job done. And because it gets the job done, that also then creates the cap and limit to that particular skill they're executing incorrectly.
Yeah, makes
and
sense.
So when someone's forced to learn the skill because they're on flat pedals in the most effective way, then that creates a learning trajectory that is much longer and higher than generally what I see for clipless pedal riders.
Okay.
So
makes sense.
An example of that would be a bunny hop, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Can you describe what a bunny hop is and how it's different than, you know, a lot of people just pick up both wheels and they think it's a bunny hop.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's a, you know, that's a classic clipless pedal kind of go around move to, you know, you're blasting down the trail and it's pop, both tires come up and then they have to travel together and land once you clear whatever you're trying to, but, and you've got just such a limited range of height. It gets the job done, but again, totally limited. So the bunny hop movement is much more complex. and and unbelievably more powerful. So a hop is both wheels at the same time. A bunny hop is where the front tire comes up first, and then as the rear wheel approaches, the rear wheel pops up, and then both wheels land again
and how,
at the same time.
So if you're clipped in, a lot of people, what they do then is they pick up to get that back wheel up, whether it's simultaneous or not, they'll pick up with their feet and that way unweight the rear of the bike. If you're with flat pedals, or I should say with a proper technique to doing a bunny hop, how do you get that back end off the ground?
Sure. I mean, I generally would, that would probably be, I think, I don't know, lesson 12 or something.
Go to Ryanish.com to find out.
In a learning curriculum, and you know, I definitely am a fan of just gradual, digestible practices that, you know, generate that sort of muscle memory needed to then move on to the next complex version of it.
And yep.
So to answer the question, though, in there is, so I kind of have this thing I came up with called bowl theory. I don't know if you saw that.
I saw that. Yep.
Yeah. So that's a way to describe the connection between. It's not just what's happening with the feet and just what's happening with the hands as isolated entities, but there's this connection between the hands through your body to the pedals, and you can generate all sorts of sort of opposing pressures through that connection.
And, that makes sense.
And so if you lifted a bowl up, generally you'd grab from the outside and lift it up. But conversely, you can lift it up by putting your hands inside the bowl, press the hands outward against the bowl, so there's pressure, and then you can lift the bowl up in that way. So that's a similar thing as to what's happening with the hands and your feet. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
I know the answers to all these questions.
Yeah.
I just can't do them.
But I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because it's you've been mentioning body movement patterns, and I think that that's something, it's having leverage but moving your weight appropriately. These moves, you aren't static on your bike. You aren't stiff on your bike. And I know a lot of, especially people that may be listening to this podcast come from the triathlon world or the road racing world, you're pretty static on your bike. You have a pedaling position, and you don't spend much time out of the saddle unless you're climbing, right? Mm-hmm. And that's it. But when you, to properly handle a bike, even on a road bike, you have to recognize your body's weight, its position, and those leverage points as the tools that you need to use to make your bike handle better. Mm. And that's something that's really important, is that you're not, it's not just a step one, step two, step three, but you really can't, you think of that as a tool. Your body weight is a tool. Moving that body weight around and using that is effective. Something that that I wanted to ask you, and this hopefully is hopefully an obvious question, but how often do you use, or in what situations do you use a bunny hop on the dirt and then on the road? When would you use it?
Okay, cool. So yeah, for bunny hops, it's so people think of the bunny hop in terms of like what I just described, front tire up, back tire up, and you're airborne flying through the air.
Yep.
However, you know, in terms of there's kind of two ways of exerting energy. One is, you know, you're static and you're pedaling hard and you're going fast down the trail. And the other is non-pedaling oriented. So you can imagine, a roller, like the trail has like this this bump. It's, maybe not a big one, but it's enough to kind of try to slow you down. If your body's a little stiff and you kind of come up to it, it slows you down. And so the bunny hop motion of unweighting, using energy, it takes energy. Mm-hmm. Like if you just kind of allowed the bump to kind of manipulate you, you'd roll over it and be fine. But you can pretty much kind of erase the bump by doing that same bunny hop movement pattern, unweighting the front, unweighting the back, and that takes effort, but it helps you keep the momentum, keep that speed going. And so there's a ton of situations like that where that movement pattern is happening.
That's all, so that's like pumping basically and avoiding
tracks, like you were saying, unbelievable training ground for developing some of these skills.
Need to go more.
It's not just for going over logs. That's the that motion is so much more than just going over those. That's awesome. Yeah, like really good point.
Because a lot of times I'll go in, I'll be like, there's the perfect line, but there'll be a big rock in the place of it.
Yeah.
And then I'll take a bad line and then, you know, it's all over.
Yeah, again, yeah, you know, that's it. You know, if the line choice, so you're seeing the optimal line, but you don't have the skill to sort of make it smooth. And so, yeah, the optimal line, yeah, you might have to do a bunny hop, just clear, you know, some extra roots or something that are sticking up by doing the bunny hop motion, whether you're airborne or whether it's just enough to unweight each tire so you just flow over it smoothly. But then that allows you to just hit that line perfectly. And again, it's all about maintaining speed by using your body. You're expelling energy in your body, but the amount of energy that you expel from executing a technique in a beautiful, efficient way is less than when you're kind of slamming into things and having to put your foot down. And so
what sense
when you I'm guessing that you think that people should practice these skills on the trail, or I think you like the structured, like on the grass field, kind of learn all these and then apply them?
A bit of both. Of both, for sure. I mean, it's
how often do you think I should practice these? I have like a some wilderness area behind me that are just kind of, it's sagebrush and out, so there's nothing there, or I can go to grass. How often should I be practicing these skills other than my, like, on the trail?
You know, I guess it depends on how driven you are and how keen you are to learn a specific skill.
I'm driven, and I'm really bad. I'm a slow learner.
And then it's a matter of, like, looking at your schedule, and if it's close to home, whether it's a driveway or a grass field or a little wilderness area close by or park, you know, you just 20 minutes, like, you got to spare 20 minutes before you got to start making dinner or whatever. You just get out to get the heart rate up, you know, you get a little workout, and you get to refine your skills.
Like every day?
It doesn't have to be every day. No, I mean, but, you know, I wouldn't, if you're dedicated to learning a new technique, I wouldn't want you to leave. I'd want you to be on it at least every few days, just to keep up that momentum. It's like skiing. Like, you know, if you ski like once every few weeks throughout the season, you know, you're gonna be going up and down and relearning, and your muscles are gonna be like screaming at you because, you know, you got sore the first day, and then 3 weeks later you get the same amount of soreness because your muscles are like, okay, we're ready, and then nothing.
Yeah,
and then you throw it at them again. So that's the same thing with mountain biking. It's not only the movement pattern, but your muscles and your ligaments, they take hits. They start to learn what you're asking your body to do and change for that.
Will I? Is it kind of like riding a bike? Where, let's say I take a year or 6 months and I do this, will I get to a level where then, if I'm using them on the trail a lot, that they kind of just kind of stick with me? Or is it just a constant, you know what I mean? Or is this a constant thing that I always have to practice?
No, it's, in my experience, is with you. Like, once you get that skill, that movement pattern's with you. But this is where it's dangerous. For me, because it's probably even more applicable to someone like me who has gotten to a really high level technically. In my mind, I know I can do the movement pattern, but if I haven't been training up to that level and I try to do it, then it's my muscles that freak out.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you doing? I'm not conditioned for this right now. I mean, I guess it's the same.
That happens in races for me when I climb a hill.
Yeah, it's the same principle, right?
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Yes, yeah. But it can become dangerous when there
is consequential.
A gap,
you don't just get dropped, you literally get dropped.
In our situation, we just did Cross Vegas, and we'll talk about that. But
First cross race for all of us. Well, second technically for me, but yeah.
And nice. I only put out, my normalized power was just 20 watts less than Chad, but Chad smoked me. And during the race, afterwards, they said they didn't use their brakes, only in like two sections in the whole course.
Yeah, and to be clear on this too, it's the course is it's grassy, and when you watch it on TV, it looks like the grass must be completely packed down and fast rolling, and it's not. It's like riding on Velcro.
It's like Velcro.
As soon as you quit pedaling, it was like you had your brakes on, right? So this course specifically, you would use brakes even less than a typical course. So it's not that Chad and I never use our brakes, but on this course in specific, but you didn't need to use them as much. Yeah, so, sorry, they keep going.
So much traction. So.
Every single corner I went into it, you know, feathered my brakes. I wanted the perfect one, and I just got smoked in terms
of... So you're scrubbing speed before every turn, just in the anticipation of it. So you're all bottled up and tense, I'm sure. It's just pissing away the energy and scrubbing off the speed, then having to bring it all back up. I mean, it's no wonder you worked so much harder than us and finished well behind us.
Right. Yeah, no doubt.
What would you recommend if you were my coach and I said, hey, you know, I use my brakes all the time, so these other guys didn't use it at all.
Yeah.
And my power wasn't that much, it was lower, but not that much lower. What would you have me do to fix that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's session corners. I mean, that's
sounds simple.
It sounds simple, but
I don't do it.
But I mean, that's the thing. It's you need to explore your comfort level in a gradual way.
Yeah.
Like find a corner and experiment. I mean, that's you've got curiosity. It's like, why the hell did I go so much slower? Sorry for profanities. Are profanities
allowed on this? It's okay. It's okay. Earmuffs, kids. Yeah, we're good.
It sounds like you've got the curiosity. You want to get this figured out. You don't want to be blowing all this energy. So that hopefully should inspire you to invest time in sessioning. Sessioning is an important aspect. Find a trail, find a corner that's not too busy that you can repeat sections on.
That's what I don't do is I don't repeat the same section. I'll do a long loop that's like 2 hours, and it will keep being new stuff. And I'll try to practice it, but it's not the same corner over and over and over again.
Nope. Yeah. Do the same corner, and corner is a big topic.
Yeah.
And
I'm just there's a lot going
there's
on
a
there.
Lot going on in cornering. Yeah. And so, not only sessioning, but again, just exploring your comfort level of just how willing are you to crash. You don't have to crash, but you just trying to get your mind in these corners. Like, you don't want to crash. That's why you're slow in Cross Vegas. You didn't want to crash in these corners, and so just you got to recalibrate that limit of where your comfort is. And the only
probably,
way. You, pardon?
And probably try not to dwell on the possibility of crashing, because I can't imagine when you're doing some of the things you're doing, like balancing on a rail 10 feet off the ground. I've seen you do it.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that's even on your mind.
No, it's not. And that's the thing. You need to get to the point where it's not on your mind. Yeah. And you do that. I do that on just pavement parking lines. Just sessioning the parking line. Oh, wow, look, I've just balanced down this for like 20 feet without going on to the other, crossing that line. And then, boom, you do it on a curb.
Yeah.
Same thing, whether it's cornering, whatever it is, it's that gradual buildup of confidence. And there's no shortcuts.
Yeah, I was getting better and better. And then I have a fat bike, a mountain bike. We'll talk about the bike in a second. But anyways, I wanted a corner, and I took it wrong, and my front wheel drifted off a little bit and went to an off camber, and I washed out pretty hard.
Yeah.
And then, so now when I go into corners, I keep remembering that crash and not wanting my front wheel to wash out. And then I had another crash where my front wheel washed out that jammed my wrist for like 3 weeks, and I couldn't type, which is bad for a computer company.
Yeah.
So then I got this thing where like, oh, my front wheel's gonna wash out. And that's what I think about whenever I go into these
turns.
Yeah, and it just happened again on a switchback at North Star, a race there.
Yeah,
I took that wrong. My front wheel washed out.
So I mean, so you know, as your coach, it would be it's because corners are complicated. There's a variety of things to explore, and you know where your weight is distributed on your tires at certain sections of the corner is something to then start to pay attention to. So when you're doing the corner, have that in your mind. Be observant. Collect data. And this whole process of being curious, experimenting, trying, it's that takes energy. It takes mental energy. You just want to just keep. Most people, they just want to get out and flow and get rid of their stress by burning some energy. But if you're really wanting to get faster and to reduce the fear and some of the mind games, then there's no other way but to to bring that curiosity and session.
Let's get into the mechanics of this really quick. So you mentioned body weight distribution on the bike, and this is something that I think a lot of people are terrified of, putting too much weight onto the front tire because they're terrified of going over the front, right?
Right, right.
And that is, I would say, in many cases, especially from the roadside, I'll just ask, have you noticed that with a lot of people that come over to mountain biking, and they don't weight the front end enough?
Yeah, totally. And you know, that's then it can swing the other way, is because, the common coaching cue is get weight onto the front wheels, you know, around corners, and then, you know, get in that ready position. And then, you know, sometimes those kind of couple tips can also backfire in other situations, because it's so complex. Such a broad range of things happening in every corner, and every corner is different. So it might actually trigger someone to get too far over the front wheel, whereas it's more, most people, like a lot of people, will be more weighted on the back wheel. They need to bring the weight forward, but it doesn't mean more weight on the front wheel than the back wheel.
Yeah. Right.
Does it get to the point where you don't think about it and you just feel it?
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. That's
why you have to experiment.
That's what
and
you
got
to get to. And you know, as kids, you know, kids learn differently than adults.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm really focused on understanding adult learning, because we've got this fear thing, and whether it's conscious fear or unconscious fear, a lot of times is unconscious, and the, you know, we might try to say we don't have fear, but unconsciously our body knows we do, and will tighten up and mess us up. And so that's,
that makes sense.
There's, it gets complicated.
Maybe if I do a cornering session, experiment with that until I don't have to think, okay, 60-40% weight.
Yeah.
Outside pedal.
Yeah. Right. And to be clear, I never once think of that. Right now I had, my father was a ski instructor, and he was a very regimented ski instructor. So he had mechanical things for me to do, and then he would make me repeat them ad nauseum until they became just natural. Right.
Yeah.
And then
once
I would learn the mechanics, then I'd be able to apply them to dynamic terrain out on the trail, or in this case, when I was skiing out on something else. I applied the same thing to riding, and we never think of that when we're riding down a trail. We don't think of that stuff. It's second nature. We utilize the tools that we've developed. But in order to get there, you really do have to slow things down, and you really have to focus on the mechanics of it.
I think about every turn that comes up, I'm like, which pedal out? Okay, left pedal. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not natural for me at all. And I tighten up.
I feel like this is like a self-help.
Yeah, I need to practice.
So, I feel like that we brought Nate on here for
And what's nice is at the company, I can just go out in the parking lot, or there's a park. I just go at lunch every day for many days. So let's talk about how to practice, because I've seen this on your site. Oh, it's one thing to know about Ryan, too, that if you sign up for his stuff, there's a comment section, and you are the man for answering people's questions. You answer every question. It's usually within like 24 hours. And
that's pretty good.
I'm going to post some videos too.
Please,
you like that, right?
That's for me as a coach, having a visual, like technology, being able to for members to post videos of their practice session. I love that. It takes a little extra effort from them to do that, but the accuracy of advice I can provide is just way better. So
that's, thank you for doing that, and I'm going to take advantage of it. But because I'm racing cross for the first time, and that, it's, my skills are getting a lot better. Mountain bike, cross country. I have a nice bike now, but a Yeti 4.5C with 114 mil of travel.
114 rear, 130 up front.
Oh, yeah, right. Yep. And then we bought a P3, a specialized P3. That's not a Cervelo, like time trial. It's like a dirt bike.
Yeah.
Or a dirt jump bike, a BMX bike.
Pump jacks and just messing around.
Take to the track to practice. What bike should I use? Should I do a variety of these? If I'm going to learn like manuals or bunny hops, should I learn on the P3, or should I do all my cornering right now in season on my cyclocross bike or mountain bike? Should I switch them around?
Yeah.
I'm
generally a big fan of sessioning and practicing on the bike that is your number one bike that you're going to be riding, because once you learn a skill, you can translate it to pretty much any bike. But, through the process, it's nice to be able to not have to, as you're going through the learning process, it's nice not to have to always recalibrate to your trail bike when you're out riding.
Yeah.
So in general, I I'm a fan of practicing on the bike that you spend most of your time on.
But if I were to go to the pump track, do you think I should bring the P3?
I mean, that's what that bike's for.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. I would say make sure you bring your mountain bike. Yeah, as well, you know.
Or your cross bike if it's in cross season.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, why not? Like, you know, you experiencing that terrain on that bike is going to contribute to your understanding of how that bike works on corners, and that's, you know, pump tracks are great for that. So, in season, yeah. If you've got time to dedicate to always sessioning, say the P3, then you know, maybe you choose a skill like the manual, and you just work in the manual on the P3, and
yeah, and just to get that kind of skill up, because it might be hard on a.
It's hard on a cross bike. Manualing is very difficult.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
So something like that, maybe even bunny hops. It's nice to have a hardtail, but it's not essential by any means. You don't need that to learn the skill.
I was thinking the P3 might be nice, too, because it's already got the flat pedals on it. So I don't have to, like, switch anything.
Oh, yeah, and that's a tricky one, too. I haven't quite wrapped my head around what to suggest to riders who have one bike, they're racing, they use clipless pedals. Are they really going to change and swap the pedals out, like, every other day?
I got these flats that clip in. Have you seen those?
Which pedals
are they?
It's
like a piece of plastic of flats that they'll clip into like SPDs.
Mm-hmm.
But they were so hard to get in, and I don't think they were very good.
Yeah, you can get platform. You can get like Crank Brothers makes a mallet 50 feet or mallet pedal. I think it's called the mallet. And it's got their clip-in mechanism in the center, and then it's got a platform on the outside. And you can use a normal, like a flat shoe with that pedal. And then you can also use a shoe that has cleats so that you can clip in. Granted, it may not feel like a really good normal platform flat pedal that's going to have like a really good traction and shape to it, but it still gets the job done. The one thing to, and really quick on a gear side of things, you'd be amazed at how, and I'm using air quotes here and you can't see it, but how clipped in you are or you feel when you have a flat pedal with shoes that are made specifically for riding. It makes a massive difference. What do you use when you ride? What are your pedals and shoes of choice, Ryan?
Yeah, I'm using the Shimano flat, the Saint flat pedal, and the Shimano flat shoes.
Yep, and they're made specifically for riding.
Sticky rubber.
Yep,
on the soles.
And a more or less kind of flat, like a flatter surface than what people think. The shoes don't have spikes on them or anything at all.
No, not like a trail runner or anything like that, where the bumps are too broad and spaced out. Like these specific mountain bike shoes are. They're much smoother, almost closer towards a skate shoe, but not quite that smooth. There's still ridges, but they're tight.
Yeah.
Could you use a skate shoe too?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
definitely. I did that, you know, for the first part of my career. It was skate shoes. There wasn't as much specific shoes for mountain biking, but now there are, with great protection too on the inner ankle. You know, having that protection there is a good thing. You know, something to control shoelaces.
So here's what I think I should do. And I've talked about this before, but I haven't executed, but now you motivated me to do it. So the power part, I've got that handled with Trainer Road.
Yeah.
But I should do, maybe on some of these days where I'm going to go do a outside ride, I could even do an indoor trainer ride first, but rather than focus, try to get fitness and skills at the same time, just focus on one skill. And kind of, you talk about this in your courses. Just try to focus on one thing and kind of nail it in, but to make it more consistent. I should do it at work.
Polarize your training. Yeah,
polarize your, that's a good way to put it.
That's the thing. The time that we have, everyone listening to this podcast, we're all time poor. We don't have just an unlimited resource of time. So if you have a limited amount of time, when you're training your power, make the most of that. And most people that listen to this podcast are familiar with that. And that's what Trainer Road's great for there. And then if you have time to ride outside, you can make the most of that time by, like you said, sessioning and focusing on that one thing.
Yeah. And especially if you've got a target and a goal for that practice session, something specific to work on and to observe, some structure there, then you can, you know, have a takeaway. You know, you can accomplish that small goal and
probably feels good too.
Oh yeah,
that too.
Like we talked about before, I've had that feeling like a few times, and it just feels so good. And you talk about it in your class, your lessons.
Yeah.
And so small goals. You know,
yeah.
You don't have to wait till you get that perfect bunny hop to get that feeling.
Yeah.
A few things that I wanted to go through, actually. Just go through different scenarios that people might encounter and go through what they should do on the bike. And this is going to be more just principle-based stuff. We'll provide the context, and then you can provide the principles, Ryan. So,
cool.
But the first thing I wanted to talk about with this is common mistakes you see people from the road or triathlon world, for example, when they get over common bike handling mistakes. They may manifest themselves, or these mistakes may be manifest even on the road bike, but what are the common mistakes that you see roadies use when they cross over to mountain biking or anything like that?
Yeah, so you guys touched on it briefly. Number one is just that locked in cockpit of position on the bike. There, you know, it's number one is exploring the full range of bike body separation in every direction, up, down, left, right, rotational, like just that can be done on the flat ground anywhere. So that needs to be explored as soon as possible, for sure.
That's a great point.
I like the term explore too.
Yep.
To feel where it's at, because I think that's a key thing that I'm not doing. And instead of like practice, it's explore. How does this feel?
Yeah, I think Nate's super analytical about all this. He's thinking about so much rather than just letting himself feel it and experience. Yeah.
He is a software engineer.
It is. I'd be like, okay, this is 30 PSI on my tires. Now let's try it with 29 and a half.
Yeah.
29.
Yeah.
Write that down. And
yeah, no.
So something, Ryan, along those lines, something that I do, and maybe you have a suggestion with this, but a lot of the time before I go out for a ride, especially I notice at the end of a hard work day, if I'm stressed or anything else, when I park at the trailhead, hopefully it's paved because this really helps because that improves my confidence in my traction, which is nice. But if it's not paved, it's still possible. But what I'll do is I will spend time exploring that space. I'll do tight turns, figure eights, something like that, where I'm standing up and I'm separating the angle of the bike from my body.
Yeah.
And I'm really letting, like you said, exploring the limits of that bike body separation by just leaning my bike over and doing some tight turns, leaning it the other way, doing some tight turns, leaning back, leaning forward, and just really kind of doing that every time before I ride, I notice a big benefit once I get on the trail.
Cool.
And
yeah.
Do you have any, I guess, pre-ride exercises that you've done beforehand like that or you could recommend?
It's very similar. You know, for me, even every first bit of trail that I'm on before I get the speed going, before I kind of trying to drop into that kind of flow, it's exploring traction on the ground, like what are the trail conditions like, you know. There's things like compressing your tires, compressing like just short down weights, especially on some sort of easy corners at the beginning, just to get a sense of just how well the tires are digging in to the particular dirt on that particular kind of day.
Do you try to push it to the limits where it kind of slips a little bit?
I do. Yeah, I do. And you know, in general, the more you can do those small little bursts where you feel a little bit of traction, the better you understand where that breakaway point is, such that, you know, you can begin more confidently flowing a corner in a smooth way than you could if you didn't explore.
Yeah, you don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. So
like a systems check, so to speak. You can kind of calibrate the rest of you to operate in those circumstances, right?
Yeah. And also a lot of riders, you know, on steep terrain, just there's often, more often than not, body weights too far back.
Mm. Because that's something that they're told, right? Get your weight back if you're on a steep hill.
Right.
Right.
Which is, again, things get complicated and confusing because when you're using brakes, you need to have the appropriate amount of weight moving back to counteract the force, the stopping force. But if you're kind of flowing a steep section without brakes, then you're gonna want your tires fairly evenly weighted. You're gonna want to be with the bike, and in that range, in that sort of neutral position, so your body can react in every direction to prevent a crash, or you know, to absorb certain bits of terrain. That homeostasis position on the bike is kind of the home, but you don't want to be locked in it. You want to react and then get back to that position. React yeah. and then get back as quick as possible.
That's the next thing I wanted to touch on was body positioning. So I coach a high school mountain bike team, and we have some new kids, and I learned a lot from taking pictures of them. And then we went over and we looked at the pictures. Some of the kids are fantastic descenders. They're like little magicians on the bike. They put me to yeah. shame. It's amazing. Yeah. One of them the other day, by the way, he's a relatively new rider in the sense that he's only been riding for a few years, right? Compared to the most of us adults who've been riding for longer than that. Mm. He rode a whole, Nate knows this loop. It's called the Dry Pond Loop in our area. He rode it on a unicycle. It's amazing. And it's a rough mountain bike trail, right? And these kids just have fun on their bikes, and yeah. that's how they get so good at it. But we took pictures of those kids, and we looked at the difference in body positioning. Once again, this is a thing that varies depending on context and exactly what you're doing. But are there any principles or any guidance that you give to people usually in terms of body positioning, where to put their weight or what to do with their body on the bike?
For sure. And this is, again, this is where it's tricky. As a coach, I'm really trying to be careful of hucking out like a tip just because mountain bike terrain is so varied. So like ready stance or ready position on the mountain bike is a pretty common set of instructions, you know, where you're more or less in the center, your elbows are out, and you demonstrate this is the ready position, this is how you want to be. But then it's like, then that is kind of the one thing that's kind of overemphasized, and it can actually cause stiffness again. Mm-hmm.
I've read about that, oh, yeah. and I just try to lock into that. I'm like flexing my muscles.
No, yeah. So I just want to be careful. So yes, that sort of links to that homeostasis kind of position I was talking about, where you're able to absorb and push the bike in any direction. But it's a very fluid position. It's not one position. It's like constantly changing and moving. It's not just ready, and then you use it. It's like constantly changing and moving. So again, that exploratory, curious attitude. So you can take an instruction like that, and explore it yeah. in an experiential way, like really mm-hmm. tuning into the feedback that your body's giving you on terrain that is comfortable enough so you can
and
build the that's confidence.
I think the two things I need to do is, one, dial back the terrain.
Totally.
So there's no fear. Yeah. And then if I'm going to think of something, I'm just going to think, relax.
Yeah.
Relax.
And that's the key. And you mentioned something, you know, when you're exploring that space, get feedback. And you'll know what that feedback is. It's when you feel that you are out of sorts, off balance, or when you feel a loss of traction in the front wheel or something else like that. Those could be signs that you could improve where you're at, right?
Yeah. And not write it off as, oh yeah, mountain biking's hard and scary.
Exactly.
It's like, okay, I noticed that. What happened? Let's maybe go back and try that section of trail again. Maybe try a slightly different position. Maybe think back to a drill or practice a coach told you to sort of bring into that situation, and then see how that works.
With braking, let's talk about braking. A lot of people are afraid to brake with their front brake specifically because they don't want to go over the front. And
totally.
On mountain biking, it's even more tricky because on road, a lot of us, when we use our front brake, it's pretty rare that we lose traction because we're over braking, right? But on a mountain bike, you have powerful disc brakes
yep.
and you have a lack of perfect traction. So it's easy for that front end to wash out. So what do you do in terms of front and rear balance and body positioning when you brake?
So I was hinting at that before in terms of, you know, if I was just staying in that neutral position and grabbed a handful of front brake, I'd go flying.
Right.
But on the other hand, I can be going at the speed. I can grab a handful of front brake. I can lock my front wheel up and have it skid if my body weight is in the right position. So again, those are kind of the two extremes, and there's a spectrum mm-hmm. between that. And so when you start to get on the trail, again, like the thing that you're looking for is like tires losing traction.
Mm-hmm.
And so that from braking, when a tire loses traction from braking, you're doing something wrong. Rear tire is often, you're using your rear brake too much and the rear wheel's skidding, and then anytime it starts to skid, you're out of control, and not to mention you're tearing up the trail. So
yeah, and you're not braking faster when your tire's locked up, right? That's the other thing. Say you're not slowing down more effectively.
No, yeah. Exactly. And so that's where, relying on the front brake, more so exploring the body position necessary to use the front brake more is a really important thing, again, to explore. I mean, it's so easy for riders just to, you can ride for a year or two and not have really truly explored that, how much power the front brake can contribute in a controlled way when you're on a downhill section. The moment the rear wheel's sliding, it's probably a good sign that you're not using enough front brake, or it's a section where a lot of times it's better not to brake at all if it's a short enough section. That sounded a little, that was a little complicated, but.
Well, one of your courses has where I did it and actually did practice this one, where you're kind of going forward and you jam on the brakes, but you're doing one where you feel yourself go forward, and another one where you drop your heels and you put your weight back, and there's so much more stopping force.
It's amazing.
That's actually one skill that I think I've gotten better at. Yeah, then you attack position and you brake, it feels not safe. And then when I drop my heels and lean back, it's like I'm pushing into the ground. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, mm-hmm. And there's so much more traction. So
totally.
One skill learned.
Dropping heels, that helps so much. It really does. Yeah. It drops your weight lower. It also allows you, like you said, to put even more traction and place that weight dynamically. Yeah, that makes sense. Another thing, switchbacks. When people get to tight switchbacks, any tips that you can give people to handling that?
Down or up?
Let's handle down first, then up.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, this is an intimidating... Yeah, it's a scary... Again, it's a scary situation.
And you can't find a trail without a switchback in our area. They're all over the place.
And these are slower speed, tight
switchbacks.
Almost like there's not enough space to get around it.
That's what you feel like every time, right?
Yeah. And is it scary at times because it's steep or...
Yeah, I think that's what people mostly feel is that it's on a switchback. They feel that they don't have enough room to turn. It's too tight. And then they also, in most cases, you're usually climbing up or down with those switchbacks too. So yeah, there's an element of grade mixed into it as well.
Mm-hmm,
so
sure.
Yeah, what should they do in those cases?
Yeah, so again, it's situational, but in general, the slow speed stability and confidence is massively important, because what is common in those situations is there's two things. One is the weight is gonna go too far back out of fear and being nervous about the corner. So your weight's too far back, and then it can kind of throw the front wheel traction off. It can kind of throw your ability. You've limited one range of motion completely, so you're capped because. You know, so there's no more maneuverability because you're too far back. So that's one, and the other is on the I'm trying to, yeah. I can't remember. There's another common trap. Oh yeah, and the torque that can come on the front wheel, like coming around a corner, it's like sometimes it's a tight corner and it feels like there's a lot of strength that's often needed to prevent the front wheel from kind of turning one way or another from the terrain or from the forces. So having enough strength on the handlebar, especially if there's a few bumps around the corner, because your weight's back, less weight on the front, it's easy for it to kind of
tuck underneath
in a quick way. So the track stands are a prerequisite for controlled switchbacks up or down. So that position that you're in the track stand, the ability to brake in a very smooth and modulated way for one of these tight switchbacks is also really important. Again, that nervousness can create that sort of herky jerky, and then boom, that sacrifices traction. Boom, that sort of makes your weight kind of go back and forth in a scary kind of way. So that needs to be worked on, that modulation ability, and that can be done in a very controlled setting. So those are just a few things off the top of my head. So
yeah, when you build those fundamentals and you get into a complex situation like that with the switchback and you feel much more comfortable, that's kind of the key, is to focus on those fundamentals. So. Well, thanks, Ryan. We appreciate it, man.
Oh, yeah, man.
That was awesome. Yes. I'm so much excited to go. I was going to take one of the bikes here.
But keep in touch with me. Keep, like, send me notes along the way, only for motivation and accountability, but just sharing your progress and how you're.
I had this, where you're talking, I was like, I should have a set up a barrier and then show him how I bunny hop it on all three bikes.
Yeah.
Four bike, fat bike too.
It's the way to do it.
Yeah.
Why not?
Let's see if I can do it. That's probably not going to happen. But just if I can get it where I can corner things and not like lose.
Yeah.
For an example of how bad I am, everyone knows. Well, there'll be an uphill section at North Star.
I think he's over-exaggerating.
No, I'm not. Okay, listen to this. Uphill section, I'll be like top 40 on Strava. Downhill section, I'll be 1,100th out of 1,200th.
Okay, yeah.
and I think that honestly, it's just like, Ryan, you have a unique approach to breaking this down. And I hope everybody recognizes this, is the fact that we talked about circumstances out on the trail that can be complicated. And then what you did every time is you broke it down to the skills that you can do outside of those scenarios that will then make you more capable when you get into that.
It's all different.
And that's the key, right? It's a really dynamic sport. So if you focus on building specific skills outside of that in controlled circumstances, your confidence goes up and then it becomes second nature and you're able to deal with those things. So.
Awesome.
I really appreciate it, Ryan.
Yeah,
awesome.
So
where can
much.
People find
thanks
out more about you?
Check me out on ryanleach.com.
Cool.
Got all the info there about what I'm up to.
Awesome. Thanks again for joining us. Nate, report to him so then you can be accountable and get better. Thanks, guys. Talk to you next
Thank
time.
You.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.